We've been thinking for about 2 weeks now together, a group of us, about the way in which one begins to think about responding to his world and the importance of having some interpretation of what is going on in the world if you're going to respond to it. Otherwise, one responds kind of spontaneously, and it may or may not be a meaningful response. And I guess I firmly believe that in the world in which we live, it's impossible to respond spontaneously, meaningfully. Without an interpretation of what is going on and what it means, one really responds in terms of interpretations that one has inherited, or that one is kind of sucked up by osmosis, or in terms of feelings and sentiments. And I think, generally speaking, the interpretations for another period in history are not relevant for today. Now, that there are a lot of ifs, ands, and buts, but I guess I've come to the conclusion that one has to deal with his own historical epoch, his own period, and one has to view it, try to understand it, try to see it in the context of a long historical development in order to respond to it. And so what we started out to do 9 days ago now, was to look at an interpretation of the present situation, Robert Heilbrunner's The Human Prospect, in which Heilbrunner, looking at what's going on in the world, said that it's impossible for what I call the American project, which is a project of economic growth and the development of technology and a science which supports that, to continue. The world will no longer, for a long time, as it's clear to him at least, the world will not sustain that project. And a lot of the rumblings you feel, oil shortage and so forth, are just evidences of what I would consider to be the truth of his assertion that we are going to move in a different direction. Now, many people have said for a long time that we should move in a different direction, because they have been asking about whether it was human or not to be involved in what we have been involved in, many of us have been involved in, culturally, socially, economically. And so that one could have had an interpretation that would have moved one in the direction of trying to find another pattern for American existence, for the substance of American existence other than economic growth and the development of technology, if he had followed many interpretations over the last 200 years. But what Heilbrunner did for us, I think, is to show that nature is now giving us the ground for an interpretation which says no. I think it's a quite inadequate ground, because it seems to me we begin, if we're Christians, with a notion of what we're created to be. And we have some notion of what it means to be a human person, what it means to love, but it's been very difficult for us to disassociate love and Christian faith from the American project, which is economic growth, technological development, science that supports it, and our playing an important role in that. Getting a very important role. Somebody just told me today of his father, who had a job, who'd gunned all his life for this important role in this productive enterprise of ours. When he got there, he really discovered how empty, and he didn't want to be there. And so he'd taken a cut from $1,200 to $400 a week in order to, or something like that. Maybe that's not quite the figure, but it was a great big economic loss, you might say, and a change in lifestyle in order to be human. And the question is the interpretation. And then yesterday we started to look at another interpretation of existence in relation to race. That is, coming out of Heilbronner's interpretation, I've been trying to push for an understanding of existence which asks, what is the substance of our life? What is it we are about? And for many years before I began to press this so hard, I spent my life in the ghettos in Chicago trying to equalize the opportunities for black people to participate in what all the rest of the people were trying to participate in, namely the American project. And so I spent my time working in all kinds of ways with various interpretations of what the situation was and how to get some justice for black people. And I wanted to indicate the interpretation, to run over that again, that was behind what I finally came to do. It was an interpretation that came out of a fairly pessimistic view of man, but not completely pessimistic. It was a kind of a combination of pessimism and optimism, which would say men of goodwill, many people have goodwill and good intentions, but they tend to distort their grasp of the truth and their virtue, and they tend to seek their own interests in the name of the common good, and as Christians they tend to identify what they want for themselves with the Christian faith. But on the other hand, they're very serious and they try to work it through, and they do respond to the needs of other people, but it's always a kind of ambiguous response. It's all mixed up with their own self-interest. And if you're dealing with a situation between whites and blacks, then what I discovered was that the best whites would so distort the situation in the ghetto in terms of what they thought the situation was or what they thought black people wanted, that their response was very much or very far from an adequate response if you're thinking in terms of justice for black people. Now, I take it justice for black people, from my point of view, would be a situation in which black people would be, as I said to my Divinity School faculty, in which black people would be 10% of the student body of the Divinity School. There's no reason why they shouldn't be, if they had had an opportunity to develop interests and to be exposed to things and get a decent education and have a cultural opportunity which stimulated them because the opportunities were open to see some meaning in getting education. I remember the one book that was dealing with the ghetto said, well, if you graduate in this ghetto of Chicago from school, about 50% of your graduating class will be out of work. And so if you're in school and you see 50% of the class ahead of you that graduate and they're out of work, you don't have a great incentive to go to school. And all kinds of things were involved. So the principle that I used to follow and I really developed was that whenever we went into a firm and looked at it, we said, how do you get equality of results? Now, the American principle is equality of opportunity. But let's take a situation which I'm very familiar, namely the building trade, since I was a business agent for 40 Black Contracts. I got involved in all kinds of situations for journeymen, electricians, plumbers, carpenters, bricklayers, hod carriers, they're now called laborers. And in Chicago, the blacks are about 35% of the population, and the last figures I know, which are probably about 69-70, were that 3.2% of the journeymen in the construction trades were black in a city where 35%, 3.2%. And there were about 7% of the apprentices were black. It really made a tremendous effort. The Urban League had about 15 people working full-time on getting apprentices into the building trade. That's all they did. I wish I had 15 people working for me at times on the whole project, which was involved with the whole black movement. But at any rate, now, how are you going to get a picture that blacks have really been accepted into the economic community in any near future if you have, you're 35% of the population, and when you go around in a black community and you see a big project going up and everybody working on it is white? Now today you'll find some blacks on there because they know the feeling in the black community, and so they'll put all the blacks they can find in that job so as to give the black community impression that they are hiring blacks. But if you've only got 3.2%, create all kinds of problems as to how you're going to get any justice. If justice means having 35% of the building trades black, or take the metropolitan area, say if justice is getting 25% of the building trade workers black, how are you going to get that? How are you going to get that? You get 7% now in apprentices, so that's less than 25%. Say you've got 25% of your apprentices per year black, how many years would it take you to get to a place where blacks were 25% of the building trades? 40 years. 40 years. Because that's about the life of a worker. And it would take you that long before you would have justice. If you had 25%, if you really want to get equality results, which you say would be the situation if blacks hadn't been discriminated against for 300 years, you would say they would have 25%. The building trade industry is not an industry that is so difficult that the blacks can't do it. I mean, it's just clear. I've gone through every conceivable thing involving it, and anybody with a certain amount of coordination and 100 IQ or even less can become a journeyman in any of those trades. Any of those trades. The way they do plumbing now, they put almost the plumbing together, and the same with electricity. They put it most together in the shops, and they put it out, and you connect it. You connect, you know, whole great big things that have been prepared in the shops. But back at the shop, you put it together. You have to know some things, but it isn't very difficult. So that it's just a matter of injustice. So then, how do you get this unjust situation over 300 years righted, not by the principle of equality of opportunity, by saying, well, you open up your doors and somebody comes, fine. And so you say you don't discriminate in employment. So if somebody happens to come, no, you do it by compensatory opportunity. You do it the same way we talk about the culturally disadvantaged child. You have to give some kind of compensatory opportunity. So that what we would do when we went into a plant was, you know, somebody say, well, we don't have anybody to put in a manager of a chain store in a ghetto. We'd say, find him, they're on, find him developing. The lawyers would say, we can't find any black lawyers. And so Jewel would go down to a college and they would recruit persons in their junior, senior year of college, and they would promise them opportunities, and they would sometimes bring them into the stores in the summer and begin to develop them, and they were able to find people to make managers and district managers and so forth because they went out and tried to do it. They went way beyond what they would do ordinarily in order to develop this. As I used to say at a law firm, take some juniors and seniors in college and bring them into your law firms in the summer and pay their way through college. Now that takes extra money, you see. And compensatory opportunity requires money. So how are you going to get the compensatory opportunity? For the most part, you're not going to get compensatory opportunity unless it becomes economically feasible for you. President Jewell, I talked to him not long ago, said that, well, we got to make these stores in the ghetto pay. You know, it's got to be economically advantageous. Well, the way we used to operate to make it economically advantageous for them to hire these people is we said, well, we won't buy from you. If I say we, that's just the language I fell into over the years. We won't buy from you unless you do this. So you'll lose money. And then, of course, some of the chains began to take their stores out of the ghetto because they didn't want to face this kind of thing. But the philosophy, you see, the interpretation is this. If you want to get equality, two great principles in America in terms of our kind of national image, freedom and equality. I say under God, but I think we've lost that, except in a very formal sense. To put it under God gives you a different kind of freedom and a different meaning to equality, I think. But we tend to say freedom and equality. We've been going through the concept of freedom and seeing what it involved. Now we're considering equality. If you want to really support the American dream of equality, then you have to do something about 300 years of injustice, or everybody in the world laughs at you about your vocation of equality for all people, a great American dream of equality. And what I was trying to do was to make that come true, because I thought if it didn't come true, we were really going to have civil war. I really felt that back in the 60s, the middle of the 60s, I really felt that we were due for civil war. And if you lived in some circles, you really felt that very strongly. And the black community felt that it had no alternative. Now, we haven't done very much since. We've done a few things, and there's been some progress in economics, but there's been very little progress in education, very little progress in living, very little progress in many things. Comparatively, as I said yesterday, when you're talking about progress and talking about the meaning of what has happened, you have to see that the black community at one point thought it was a second-class citizen, second-class person, so its expectations were here and the fulfillment was here. But with the developments in the 50s and the 60s, the blacks thought they were human. They really began to feel they were human and first-class citizens, first-class persons. And a lot of them still don't, because they've been subjected to such a propaganda kind of effort and such an experience of it that two-year-old children will pick white dolls over black because they know the difference between being black and white. But anyway, if your expectations are way out here and your fulfillment has advanced a certain amount, the explosion gap is still there, and the explosion gap in this country is still there. So it's a very important problem for us. In trying to get equality, then, seems to me one should welcome those movements, those nonviolent movements, which are seeking equality, equality of results, and the compensatory opportunities, and the building of black power, nonviolent black power, which is seeking, you might say, to force the white person to do justly. I don't believe that the best intentioned white person in the world will do justly unless on the other side, and I often use this illustration, it's like a parent and a child. The best intentioned parent does not really do justly to his child, and it's a complex thing sometimes, unless his child resists. I remember my daughter saying to me, "No, if you don't accept this guy I'm going with, I'll move out." She was using her power. But I had a certain sense, if I lost my daughter, I lost my reputation for being a good parent and all the rest of it. That's what she was appealing to. She didn't have much power, but she had a power over my identity and my image, you know, in the community. And I think she was right. She was really right. She didn't marry the guy, and there were lots of problems, but we simply would not accept it. And some of us were very vocal about it, and she had to assert herself. Perfect illustration, and I would think, you know, it's reversed sometimes, too. I mean, I don't mean to say there's a one-sided affair between the generations, because I'd say both sides, the older generation cannot see. The younger generation has to come up, and there has to be some new things. The younger generation can't see there's any wisdom in the old, and they're both wrong. I mean, we're both wrong. So that there's a sense in which there will be a kind of struggle. So that this is a general principle, I think. There is a kind of conflict that emerges between wills and interests, and it's the same in a family. If you don't stand up for your own rights in a family, why, the other partner will run over you. In the long run, you'll be destroyed, and the relationship will be destroyed. It's a matter of standing up. Now, the situation is, with the black community, that they have never been able to muster the power in order to stand up for themselves. And that's what the Black Power Movement is all about. It's an effort to stand up, to develop self-confidence, an image of being somebody. And so Jesse Jackson always said, I worked for him for 4 or 5 years, always used to say, you know, the first, he used to have people chant, I am somebody. I may be poor, I may be in jail, I may be on welfare, but I am somebody. I'm black and beautiful. Used to chant that over and over again. I don't know what good it did. You know, you got all kinds of problems. But the point was that if the blacks didn't develop the sense of being worthwhile and being important enough to assert themselves, they get run over. So at the Black Power Movement, and I spent innumerable hours and energy in trying to develop it, was an effort to get economic and political power, that is in Chicago with Jesse, now Operation Push, get economic and political power in order to assert interests on the theory that justice comes from the interaction of interests, that you have an overarching constitutional framework which talks about equality and about freedom, but that in the interplay of forces comes a rough justice, and that if everybody isn't allowed to assert his interests, his interpretation of what justice is, what the good is, that you will have one group running roughshod over another in the name of justice, in the name of Christ. And that growing out of a real understanding of the limitations of the possibility of anybody, I don't care who you are, you need the counteraction, you need the advice and the counsel and the help of someone else to help you determine what you are and what you're not. And it was out of this kind of a theory that Breadbasket was started and functioned, namely that the blacks needed to assert their own interests if justice were to be done and if peace were to be maintained and the life of the nation to go on. Because where there is a great sense of injustice on the part of any large group of people, there's real trouble. There's just no question about it. It doesn't matter whether it's a family, whether it's a school, wherever it is. If there's a great sense of injustice that's not really dealt with, there's trouble, there's conflict, and it'll erupt one way or another. It may take 50 years for it to erupt, but it will erupt and it will come out in all kinds of ways. So the question is, was in my mind and still is, how do you work in a society where there's been great injustice, great inequality, in order to bring about equality? So the issue then, growing out of this interpretation, was equality. Equality of opportunity to assert oneself was the principle on which we started, and I really pushed this and think it has to be pushed in terms of the history of injustice on the black, to equal opportunity to assert oneself, but also the kind of opportunity, compensatory opportunity, in order to undo the injustice of 300 years.